Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I dedicate today's program to two Iranian-American women of significant accomplishment whom I have known for many years and who celebrate birthdays this month. Dr. Deborah Kamali, who is an obstetrician and gynecologist and whose birthday is today, March 9th, and Suri Mirsapasi, whose career has been in medical chemistry and biotechnology, and whose birthday is 10 days from now, March 19th. I start today's program with a few personal observations about Donald Trump's presidency, which, in his own words about nearly everything else, it's been a disaster. So I am obliged to offer a disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only, on this side of the nearest black hole. I call what I wrote, The Devil and Donald Trump. It seems evident that the United States is traumatized by the abrupt insertion of Donald Trump into its neural core, and that it is, as a whole, undergoing a national mental breakdown. The underlying themes of autocracy and aristocracy, which were physically purged with the Revolution and the Constitution, and no less by the Civil War, have never quite fully evaporated from the nation's sensibility, however much reprehensible forms of bondage have been banished from the national psyche, yet only to reemerge throughout its history. But it seems to not have succumbed so rapidly as now, in particular to such banal and preposterous obstrusity as has suddenly been manifested at and since Trump's inauguration as president. Trump represents an anti-intellectual refutation of world evolution toward unity of the human species. He despises fusion, embraces divisive turmoil and atavistic white supremacist nationalism. He is amoral without a hint of morality of any sort, a shameless purveyor of hatred and fear. Trump appears to be both a compulsive and convulsive liar. The difference between them is slight. Mark Twain said, "Truth tellers do not need a memory." Trump somersaults that illusion with a compulsive, convulsive plethora of lies so constant no one can remember what he says about anything, which is very difficult for policy making. The Constitution has had many enemies, foreign and domestic. However, most of its disruptors are homegrown zealots or power-hungry tyrants. Donald Trump might be a singular category of the usual assortment of usurpers. We will have to wait and see, although patience is rapidly wearied less than 2 months after his coronation, which is obviously how he views it, boasting of record-cheering crowd of millions that overcrowded Washington, D.C., or so he insists. In the same breath, he accuses millions of others of being fraudulent voters responsible for his woman opponent's significant majority of the popular vote. Soon enough, Trump will probably tire of small re-campaign rallies. His gaudy ego might just demand huge rallies like Hitler at Nuremberg prior to World War II. Or perhaps he might stage public entertainments like the Caesars with ICE agents in arenas assailing refugees and immigrants as the new Christians. People are surprised that the descent into tyranny and chaos is happening so quickly, but millions are pushing back, the American Spring, retaking the U.S. government from tyrannical trolls. The nation's probable recovery will come from two aspects, the most important being the growing circumspection and realization of, as one person put it, the threads that draw us together as a people, despite all our differences. The other probability is that the job of president overwhelms and unravels Trump's personal psyche, and that he undergoes a personal mental meltdown, which will remove him from the presidency. And then we will have perhaps a more deliberate autocrat who is limited by the narrowness of his intellectual concept of democracy, but which can be dealt with without the craziness or unhinged narcissism. Of course, Trump should not be allowed at any time to get close to the nuclear trigger in the course of his mental disintegration. The right-wing coup of the American presidency is tottering from its own excess of social and religious intolerance and its virtual totalitarian attempt to make the remake the U.S. government into a monarchical caricature with Trump as de facto dictator and alt-right white nationalist Stephen Bannon as his Richelieu, Goebbels, Svengali. The growing disrespect for Trump at home and abroad as a result of his chaotic deceit does not bode well for the nation or the surrounding world, which increasingly indicates its growing disdain. Of particular concern is the estimation of would-be world czar Vladimir Putin, who wishes the mantle of Ivan the Terrible and Peter the Great. Trump might seem a useful idiot, as Lenin said of Stalin, whose ruthlessness surpassed that estimation. Trump's rebuffed rashness at disregard by his mano-mano patron and proximity to the nuclear trigger is a dark thought. The Trump government is practicing what white nationalists sardonically call peaceful ethnic cleansing, with armed ICE officers rounding up undocumented immigrants all over the country, entering their homes, places of work, schools, and churches, and taking them away for confinement in private prisons. The raids resemble old newsreels of Nazis rounding up Jews, and a fear that is aroused of association with others permeates the entire society. Even though setting up concentration camps is denied, the ugly precept, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, most of whom were citizens, the private prison industry is overcrowding its cells with immigrants. The plan after ethnic cleansing of the USA is to ethnic cleanse the world. The so-called clash of civilizations, analogous to the Crusades at the first millennium of the Christian era. This new millennial world war is for the same purpose and against the same theological enemy as the medieval Crusades, which puts a sinister wrinkle to Trump's intent to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, the ancient shining city of Christendom. This is the unity Trump and Bannon want with Vladimir Putin. And despite this holy war partnership, a new Cold War is about to erupt, as well as a renewed nuclear arms race with their erstwhile ally against Islam. Trump is a misanthropic boll weevil. His edicts and midnight tweets have as many twists and turns as a bowl of pretzels. He wants to pour money into the military and arms industry and sacrifice national health care and climate change research. He will build a hammer of In God We Trust, poised not for protection of the homeland, but conquest or obliteration of infidels, a perennial fantasy of armchair Napoleons. His scourge of the media as enemy of the people is an old Stalinist diatribe, and America First, a pre-World War II American Nazi slogan. Trump's White House is a glass house, being shattered from within by deceit, stupidity, cupidity, and quite possibly collusive treachery. It resembles an idiocracy run by incompetent trolls governed by a misanthropic boll weevil. The glass ceiling might have crashed down when he tweeted last weekend that his predecessor Obama, whom he had long falsely accused of foreign birth, had tapped his phones. Donald Trump's blatant and egregious fear-mongering is compared to FDR's inaugural at the deepest part of the Great Depression, that the only fear Americans should fear is fear itself. Trump seems to be compared to William Jennings Bryan, in praise by Stephen Bannon, which prompts a contrary quote within a quote by Berkeley Snow, husband of Archcape's First Lady, Bridget Snow, both now deceased, that he wrote as a letter to the Oregon Historical Quarterly in 1967. He quoted a friend whose father was a dissident gold Democrat, opposed to Bryan's silver platform as Democratic presidential candidate in 1896, and who considered Bryan, quote, a monster, a political rascal, a cheap money thief, a rule or ruin party leader, and a menace to the country. The presence, one might even say in these dreadful times, the omnipresence of Trump, is an example of our political and cultural regression. Not the savior from it, but the curse of it. We should start now to repair the wreckage of democracy that Trump will leave behind, whenever and however his presidency ends. Whatever outrage or havoc he does that we are yet unable to anticipate, it is not too soon to begin mediating the damage right now, because it might make it somewhat easier to remedy the disaster later. One certainty is apparent. The United States will not afterward be called Trumpland, as it has universally been known as the land of Lincoln the past century and a half. And now, by Lee Siegel. Avoiding questions about Trump's mental health is a betrayal of public trust, which he wrote for the Columbia Journalism Review. Just about every other week, the media invites a psychiatrist or psychologist to admonish other psychiatrists or psychologists for calling Donald Trump mentally ill. This has become the default recourse when it comes to the question of Trump's health for a media relentlessly accused of being partisan, fake, and deliberately dishonest. But leaving the question of Trump's mental condition to a group of professionals is an avoidance strategy that is becoming more transparently irresponsible by the day. Since Trump declared his intention to run for president, there has been speculation on his mental state. Terms like narcissistic personality disorder and borderline personality began to appear more and more frequently in reference to him, both in the press and in the words of his opponents and their proxies. For journalists, the conflict over how and whether to address the issue is growing with every one of Trump's outbursts. At what point do the news pages, in addition to the opinion pages, weigh in? Is there a danger of trivializing mental health issues through armchair commentary? Is this even a useful storyline, given that the president's true mental state is essentially unknowable to any outsider, not least reporters? The journalistic conflict came to a head with the publication on two consecutive days in February of two letters in the New York Times. The first, on February 13th, written by two psychiatrists and signed by, as the Times stated, 33 other psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers, began by attributing the silence from the country's mental health organizations, and by implication the media, where they could make themselves heard, to the American Psychiatric Association's 1972 Goldwater Rule, an edict that must have been as obscure to other readers as it was to me. This rule, the letter explained, prohibited the psychological evaluation of public figures. The decree came in response to a survey published during the presidential election in 1964 by FACT, a muckraking magazine published by Ralph Ginsberg, known for his legendary run-ins with the Supreme Court over the issue of obscenity. FACT asked 12,356 psychiatrists if they believed Senator Goldwater was psychologically fit to be president. Of the 2,417 people who responded, 1,189 said that they believed Goldwater was not. Goldwater successfully sued Ginsburg on defamation charges, the suit eventually reaching the Supreme Court, which refused to overturn the lower court's decision. Alarmed by the incident, the American Psychiatric Association concluded that such speculation about a politician's mental health by mental health professionals who had not examined him or her was, quote, irresponsible, potentially stigmatizing, and definitely unethical. The APA then published the Goldwater Rule as an annotation in a book called The Principles of Medical Ethics, with annotations especially applicable to psychiatry. The APA feared that such speculation would make the public lose faith in the profession. The authors and signatories of the letter that appeared in the Times disagreed. They argued that too much is at stake to be silent any longer. The next day, February 14th, another psychiatrist named Ellen Francis, the chairman of the task force that compiled the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders No. 4, the Diagnostic Bible of the Psychiatric Profession, laid into the previous letter. He lamented fevered media speculation that has encouraged mental health professionals to disregard the usual ethical constraints against diagnosing public figures at a distance, quote unquote. Francis explained he wrote the criteria that define narcissistic personality disorder. The condition some mental health professionals and journalists have said they believe Trump suffers from. But Francis asserts Trump does not meet those criteria, quote, because he does not suffer from the distress and impairment required to diagnose mental disorder. He goes on to argue that Trump causes severe distress rather than experiencing it, and has been richly rewarded rather than punished for his grandiosity, self-absorption, and lack of empathy. It is a stigmatizing insult to the mentally ill, who are mostly well-behaved and well-meaning, to be lumped with Trump, who is neither. A few days later, a Times writer on mental health issues, Richard Friedman, concurred, also citing the Goldwater rule, and adding his own wrinkle: judging Trump mentally ill would let him off the moral hook. It was the sociologist Christopher Lash who made the term and the clinical condition narcissism famous when he published his best-selling 1979 book, The Culture of Narcissism: American Life in an Age of Diminishing Expectations. Lash argued that a host of economic factors, especially rampant consumerism, had converged to make people self-obsessed and self-loathing, hyper-competitive and afraid of competition, cut off from reality, unempathetic, erratic, angry, vindictive. There are plenty of flaws in Lash's Jeremiad, as there are in any set of sweeping generalizations about a society. But many of Lash's perceptions could just as well have been written yesterday. As a result of people disappearing into their own psyches, radically estranged from other people and from social norms, quote, truth has given way to credibility, facts to statements that sound authoritative without conveying any authoritative information. Rival commercial claims for a product have the general effect of blurring the distinction between truth and falsehood in a fog of plausibility. To drive home his point, Lash cites the example of President Richard Nixon's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, who at one point admitted that his previous statements on Watergate had become inoperative. Lash's most prescient insights are about individual character. A narcissistic personality, Lash wrote, will display the prevailing obsession with celebrity and a determination to achieve it at even the cost of rational self-interest and personal safety. The narcissist divides society into two groups, the rich, great, and famous on the one hand, and the common herd on the other. Narcissists worship heroes only to turn against them when their heroes disappoint them. The narcissist admires and identifies himself with winners out of his fear of being labeled a loser. His admiration often turns to hatred if the object of his attachment does something to remind him of his own insignificance. And that's Lash. Lash did not allow himself to get lost in pondering the question of whether narcissistic personality disorder should be considered mental illness. For Lash, a person possessing such traits was able to function on various levels of practical endeavor, but unable to function as a rational or trustworthy member of society. That is to say, as a human being capable of kindness, empathy, and attentiveness to other people's reality. And Lash was not even talking about presidents. Up to now, Trump's behavior has been analyzed as political inexperience, everyday insecurity, lack of attention span, calculated disruption, autocratic eruptions, even relished as a type of diversion that can be satirized by comedians. Whenever the question of his mental fitness is explicitly raised, the professionals are brought in to declare the issue unethical. The most frequent argument is that calling Trump mentally ill and deriving from that judgment the conclusion that he is therefore unfit to serve in the White House will stigmatize mentally ill people. Yet every sane person knows there are as many varieties of mental illness as there are varieties of what passes for mental health. And sometimes the line between the two is blurry, arbitrary, or downright illusory. And who among us is so certain of his or her own sanity not to doubt it from time to time? When someone is compulsively lying, continuously contradicting himself, imploring the approval of people even as he is attacking them, exalting people one day and abusing and vilifying them the next, then the question of his mental state is moot. The safe thing to do is not to just stay away from him, but to keep him away from situations where he can do harm. In a different set of circumstances, it would be better if the press ignore the question of a president's mental fitness altogether. But this is not a normal state of circumstances. There is not necessarily, to use what has become an obnoxious buzz phrase, a new normal. If you watched Trump's news conference on February 16th and thought, "This is Trump talking," then you would not have been sensitive to the profound transformations in the country that has occurred beneath the all-distracting upheavals. But if you watch from a distance, as it were, thinking, "This is the American president talking," then you would have been alarmed in a new kind of way. Psychiatrists can and should argue about whether they should speculate publicly about Trump's mental state. But it would be a mistake to marginalize that issue by specializing it and leaving it to the psychiatrist. The mental condition of the President of the United States is as legitimate a subject of journalistic concern as it is of everyday conversation. No journalist or editor needs to be told that there is both cause and justification for addressing the question of Trump's mental condition. Everyone knows that if the question were addressed in a systematic way, it would have to be done in the kind of detached, objective, rational manner that would give it credibility, especially in the current moment when Trump has turned the press into an automatic scapegoat for his own missteps. The media would have to be very careful how it raised the subject. The manner in which the question of Trump's mental health has to be handled once it is raised is obvious, of course. The more contentious question has been whether to raise it and to keep raising it. At this point, not to do so, especially for journalists, is a betrayal of the public trust, a denial of human nature, and an insult to posterity. And that was Avoiding Questions About Trump's Mental Health is a Betrayal of Public Trust by Lee Siegel, who is the author of 5 books and the recipient of a National Magazine Award for Reviews and Criticism. His forthcoming book, The Draw, a Memoir, will be published in April. He wrote this article for the Columbia Journalism Review. And now, Immigration Ban Based on Fear and Ignorance. And it's an open letter to the Newport News Times. President Donald Trump recently issued an executive order suspending all refugee admissions and an immigration ban on citizens of 7 Muslim-majority countries, specifically Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. Although there are encouraging legal action being taken in federal courts that challenge the legitimacy of the president's rash executive orders, the threat to certain individuals' freedom to travel to the United States from various countries remains in jeopardy. Therefore, we, the undersigned, reject and are deeply concerned about the ramifications and untold misery this has caused our own citizens and those who long to come to our country. According to the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, since 1975, 0 Americans have been killed on U.S. soil by foreign terrorists, quote unquote, from the 7 countries listed in Trump's immigration ban. including those murdered in the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, 9/11, the chance of an American perishing in a terrorist attack on U.S. soil that was committed by a foreigner over the 41-year period studied here is 1 in 3.6 million per year. And that was by the Cato Institute, January 25th this year. For our government to halt those wishing to come here for an indefinite time period is to deprive them of their and their family's safety and security and relief from strife in their homelands. The February 2, 2017 article in the New York Times by Nicholas Kristof noted, a Reuters poll found that many Americans approve of Trump's travel ban, but that's not surprising. When we're fearful, we're vulnerable to politicians who play on our fears and scapegoat immigrants. In the fullness of time, we come to regret our xenophobic behavior and to appreciate the immigrants. It becomes obvious this immigration ban is based upon our fear and prejudice and is selective. This ban is detrimental and injurious to our national interests and security. While this may be no surprise, these attitudes have played out in our history, with the most noteworthy being interning of Japanese Americans during World War II. This type of posturing from our government only plays into our most basic of fears and right into the hands of those who promote America First as the only game in town. This makes our country weaker rather than stronger. While this dangerous situation needs our attention and pushback, we are deeply concerned it is a smokescreen created to distract us from other efforts to undermine our freedoms and true security. We desperately need to be diligent in being aware of detrimental actions happening in backgrounds and around corners hidden from public scrutiny. We encourage all who remember the tragedy of our World War II history to ensure that we do not repeat such a travesty against our country's founding principles. To remain silent in these tenuous days is to be complicit in the violation of basic constitutional rights, as well as the inherent values in our country's foundation. To quote Carl Schurz, 13th U.S. Secretary of the Interior, my country, right or wrong? If right, to be kept right, and if wrong, to be set right. May we all do our part in welcoming the stranger, offering assistance to those who seek to participate in our democracy and who offer their services to making our country strong as we the people live fully the motto of our great country, E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. And this is signed by concerned citizens of Seal Rock and Mackay, Oregon. Amy Williams, Reverend Elizabeth Jones, Reverend Artis Leete, Terence Sly, Mary Cutting, John Bringetto, Amanda Burks, Stan and Bonnie Ferguson, Bonnie Gattrell Truax, and John and Kathy Vickers. This letter was printed in the Newport News Times on March 3, 2017. And this has been Michael McCusker. I hope you enjoyed International Women's Day yesterday.